Being 8 o'clock, we'll get the meeting of the State Government Finance Division called to order. Representative Quam, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have reviewed the minutes and find them adequate.
Representative Quam moves that the minutes for March 11th, 2020 be approved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the first bill on our agenda this morning is House File 1424. Representative Stevenson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll move House File 1424 to be held over for possible for further consideration. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1424 is a bill to address the increasingly problematic student loan crisis that is sweeping the nation. Across the United States now, there's over $1 trillion of student loan debt. Student loan debt is the second largest form of debt held in the United States. It is a larger amount of debt than credit card debt, unbelievably, at this point. So it's second only to mortgage debt. It is a problem that is hitting Minnesota as well, over $27 billion worth of student loan debt here in Minnesota. And make no mistake, this is not a metro problem. This is not a suburban problem. This is a problem that affects all of Minnesota. Over 50% of millennials living in greater Minnesota have student loan debt. And a recent study by the Federal Reserve Bank indicated that student loan debt is a primary driver of the reason why young people are choosing not to live in greater Minnesota. What this bill does is it tries to get some protections for our students against abusive and misleading and fraudulent activities by student loan servicing companies. It establishes a number of prohibited practices that student loan servicers can't engage in, including misapplying payments, giving students bad or false misleading information. It also, and relevant to this committee, creates an office of a student loan advocate inside the Attorney General's office and gives the Attorney General's office enforcement powers designed to curb those abuses by the student loan servicing companies to make sure that students are able to get the programs and relief that they are entitled to under existing law. So that is kind of a thumbnail sketch of the bill. I know the committee has a limited time today and also limited jurisdiction over the bill, so I'll maybe leave it at that, Mr. Chair. I know we have a few testifiers.
And members, the bill before us is because it has funding for the Attorney General's Office and the Attorney General's Office, Section 11 and Section 13. And 11 is the enforcement provision, and then 13 is the appropriation. And if we can try and limit our questioning and testimony to that, because that's what we have jurisdiction over, we can stray a little bit, but we've got other bills to take up today, and I'd like to get this done today. So, Representative Stevenson, I have an Adam Welly on my list from the Attorney General's office. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Adam Welly, W-E-L-L-E. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Consumer Wage and Antitrust Division over at the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. I'm here first to express that the Attorney General strongly supports House File 1424 as necessary to bring some accountability to an industry, student loan industry, that affects 750,000 Minnesotans. The Attorney General's Office has put in a fiscal note on this bill, and you have that to review, but I'll try to touch on some of the high points of that note here in this testimony. The bill, House File 1424, touches on the Attorney General's office in mainly two ways. First, as Representative Stevenson mentioned, to address some of the worst abuses and misleading practices we're seeing within the student loan servicing industry, it creates the student loan advocate position. This would really provide a voice and a resource for student loan borrowers across the state who are experiencing issues and problems in the student loan servicing industry. It's an industry that's marked by complexity and power imbalances and information imbalances between that favor servicers and lenders. And so this advocate position would be there as a resource to receive complaints, mediate those complaints, assist borrowers reviewing loan histories, analyze complaint data, make recommendations to agencies in the legislature, and really be a voice for borrowers in this industry. Second, it outlaws some of the worst practices we've seen in the industry and provides enforcement authority to the Attorney General in that respect. So the fiscal note identifies some of the costs associated with those duties. I'll first note that the Attorney General's office is well suited to take on some of these tasks. We have a consumer services division. That division receives 400 to 500 calls a day, responds to 40 to 50 letters and complaints a week. Last year, it obtained more than $4 million in money back for consumers. And then we also have an enforcement division with attorneys, investigators who bring enforcement actions. So within that infrastructure, this fiscal note provides for two positions. Mainly would be the first would be the advocate position, and the duties of the advocate are set forth in the bill. I've Representative Stevenson mentioned what some of those duties are. And then second would be an investigator. These complaints over student loan servicing are very fact-intensive. They require review of complicated loan histories. Oftentimes, borrowers do not understand the nature of their loan, who owns their loan when they're sold and transferred among servicers and debt collectors. And so the investigator would be there to assist in having expertise in student loan financing and assist borrowers, help identify issues, assist the advocate, and also assist in potential enforcement actions. Otherwise, the Attorney General's office existing tracking and consumer complaint systems, staffing, and other infrastructure avoids the need for other administrative expenses. I will add that the fiscal note mentions on the revenue side that there is the potential down the road for revenue from enforcement actions that the Attorney General's office may bring. When we do see a pattern or practice of misleading or abusive conduct that violates the law, our office can bring enforcement actions, and among other remedies, we can obtain civil penalties, which by statute must be deposited into the general fund. It's almost impossible to predict how those types of actions will play out, whether and how many actions are brought in a given year, and even if they're brought, what the remedies will be and what kind of civil penalties may result. So it's something on the revenue side that may occur down the road, but it's really practically impossible to predict what that could be. So those are the high points. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Do we have any questions for the Attorney General's office? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In looking at what is provided in the fiscal note, a couple questions that I don't see answered, but how many people, FTEs, would this comprise that would establish this student loan advocate position?
Mr. Welly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, two full-time positions, the student loan advocate position and an investigator.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry if I didn't write your name down. The Welly. Testifier?
Welly, W-E-L-L-E, yep.
All right, thank you. Mr. Welly. Under the provisos of the Attorney General's office now, we are in agreement that you already have the authority to enter into a review of private contractual arrangements between a loan company and an individual if that individual brings that to your attention, correct?
Mr. Welly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have a Consumer Services Division. We are legally allowed to assist consumers, and we do assist consumers to the extent we can on some of these issues currently.
Representative Alden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you already have a Consumer Services Division, which would comprise of the ability and the veracity based upon the legal expertise within that department to handle this work, why are you separating this out for the specific purpose of talking about this when you already have that ability within a department?
Mr. Welly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I mentioned before, we do get around 400 to 500 calls a day, 40 to 50 written complaints that we are mediating. It is a substantial demand on the Consumer Services Division. I think what this bill does is recognize that this is, as Representative Stevenson mentioned, a student debt crisis, and that this position and that these duties that are outlined of the student loan advocate are absolutely necessary and must be mandated and funded to ensure that there is a voice and a resource for borrowers in this respect.
Representative Stevenson, you want to say
yeah, something? Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I think that while the Attorney General has certainly some abilities to pursue consumer protection actions, there's a serious amount of new protections that are encoded in law in this bill that aren't in law currently and would give the Attorney General new tools and new protections for student borrowers. I also think it's important and significant to have someone who is specifically designated to be an advocate for student borrowers to enforce this law and to be a touch point for students to go to, for borrowers to go to when they have concerns. There's also pieces in the bill instructing the student advocate to create an educational program to help students stay out of trouble in the first place. That, of course, is not happening currently. So the bill goes well above and beyond what is within the current powers and ability of the Attorney General's office.
Representative.
I just have a couple of questions. Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stevens, the Office of the Attorney General is already mandated to respond to concerns and or inquiries made by the public. To suggest that 400 queries are made in this regard, I think is subjective. Some of them are probably just looking for advice in terms of how you might move forward on an individual basis. I don't know that all of them are necessarily responsible to legal actions. The other point that you made that we talked about the last time that I heard this bill in judiciary was that this is symptomatic of a larger problem, that rather than have the Attorney General put out an educational responsibility, that's really the purview of higher ed. That's really the purview of our K-12 system. That's really the purview of those that are raising the children. What you're doing is you're responding after the fact to say, now that we have a problem, which is has not been a problem in crisis mode just this year. I served 25 years in the financial services industry. This has been around since before I got into that career path. So to suggest that two attorneys, as Mr. Welly has suggested, are mandated by the responsibilities of the Attorney General's office to take on this specific task, I think is a bit of a reach when the overall objectives of the Attorney General's office already mandate that. We don't need more people, more FTEs. Each one of our offices probably has been receiving 400 texts or emails a day just because of the current crisis with COVID-19. I don't know that we're going to be asking for additional services either. I think you're asking for something that the Attorney General can already do based upon the staff that they have. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just wanted to say that this fiscal note is a really good fiscal note and really explains, I think, quite well why two staff are necessary in the varying responsibilities. And you can't really do one without the other. You know, would be my kind of rebuttal of what's being said is that if you have a student loan advocate to do it and it surfaces things, you need to then be able to have the other position to do the work, and one without the other doesn't seem like that would work. And I think this is a really wise approach because I think it would be short-sighted if you didn't approach it with this kind of two-pronged way within the Attorney General's office, which I think is why it's so important that the student loan advocate be there, because it wouldn't fulfill all of the duty, you know, all of what you're trying to accomplish if you just had the Attorney General's office as is be doing this without the student loan advocate. So I think this works really well in tandem, and I think the fiscal note does a great job explaining these assumptions. So I think this is a great bill.
Thank you, and I've got further testifiers here, and thank you, Mr. Welly. And if you have more questions, we'll call you back down.
Thank you, Mr.
I have a Lori Hack. And after that, I have an Andrew Wold on my list. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Lori Hack, L-O-R-I, Hack, H-A-A-K. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lori Hack, and I teach biology at Simley High School in Invergrove Heights. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today in support of House File 1424. Teaching is my second career after a 10-year career in water resources management, most of which was spent with the city of Chanhassen. I realized I had a passion for teaching teenagers. I enrolled at Hamline University in 2007 to get my teaching license and my master's degree. I had a house but had already paid off my undergraduate student loans. I had very little other debt. Student loans allowed me to get my teaching license and get enough credit so I could see a time where my salary would begin to compare to what I was making as a young municipal employee with no advanced degree. While it is easy to borrow money to get through school, navigating the system during repayment is incredibly difficult. For starters, loan services frequently place me in and out of deferment without my knowledge, even if I just enroll in a summer class for a couple of credits. This decision means I accrue interest without my consent, even though I can make payments. This increases my loan balance for no reason other than loan servicers make money over time. Loan servicers should be required to communicate those actions to borrowers. I have struggled to get accurate information about very basic things. As an educator, I've been able to take advantage of a federal teacher loan forgiveness program to help with some, though not all, of my student debt. The application requires you to send the request for forgiveness to multiple servicers, but does not require the servicer to communicate the status back to me. As a result of consistent misinformation and failure to communicate with me by several loan servicers, the loan forgiveness that typically takes 3 months from start to finish took 9 months. All the while, my loan balance was still accruing interest that it need not have accrued. I'm really glad that this bill also creates an advocate in the Attorney General's office to help with these problems. Last week, as I found as I was reviewing my statements that my loan servicer cannot even accurately calculate how many required payments I've made on each of my loans that are eligible for public service loan forgiveness. Some correspondence from my lender dated November 16th, 2019 says I had made 59 payments toward the total required 120. Correspondence dated November 23rd, just 1 week later, reduced that number from 59 to 13. And that without a single thing changing about my loan during that time. I'm fortunate in that I have had support from my union to keep tabs on this. Not everyone is eligible for loan forgiveness, and most Minnesotans do not yet have anyone who can help them navigate the hurdles loan servicers place in our way. For this reason, I hope you will support House File 1424, which will help borrowers like me repay our loans, understand repayment plans and loan forgiveness options, and provide an advocate for everyone trying to do the right thing. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. The next I have is Andrew Wold. And after that, I have a Mike Soon, her son. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Andrew Wold. That's W-O-L-D. I'm senior staff attorney at the Office of Higher Education. Thank you for having me. I'm here to discuss briefly just the possibility of some technical amendments to the servicer bill. I want you to know first, the office is in full support of the policy behind this bill. However, there are a few considerations to take into account to facilitate the implementation of the bill in practice. First, the language regarding the partial payments does not distinguish by loan program or lender, which means if a borrower submitted a coupon for a Minnesota self loan, a payment for a Minnesota self loan payment and also has loans with another lender serviced by our servicer, payments would need to be applied across various lenders' loans. So if they returned the coupon from our statement with a partial payment, then it would go to whatever loan balance is lowest. And so that, I don't know if that's the goal of the statute. Additionally, the decision to transfer to another servicer is made by the lender and not the servicer, unless the servicer is terminating the contract, which they may do if the lender isn't paying their invoices. The bill states a sale or transfer must be completed no less than 7 days from the date of the next payment due, and if there's a conversion to a new servicer, it will occur on one date for all loans. They could not transfer loans daily to meet the 7-day requirement on all loans. Normal procedure is to send transition information to borrowers, and the old servicer forwards payments to the new servicer. So I believe that all of you have the letter from our loan servicer's parent company, Nelnet, as well, and some of their proposed changes in support. And I would be happy to take any questions if you have any.
Representative Claiborne,
I just have a question for you, Mr. Chair. Are these, because of the work that we're doing, we're talking about whether or not the position should be funded in the Attorney General's office, are these changes that could be made at the next stop, or are these changes that we need to discuss today?
It's already been through higher ed. I think the next stop would be from here if it gets in, if we move this forward and fund it out of our, the Attorney General's piece out of our target, would be the Ways and Means. My suggestion would be, this is already heard in higher ed, between there and here, those suggestions should have been made. We're going to be holding this over for possible further consideration. I would say, I would ask you, and I wrote myself a note here that when you got done, to ask you to work with the author and work with him, because I don't know if he's heard about these before right now, but if you work with the author to try and come up with if there are changes that need to be made, I'm sure the author would be willing to talk. And I see Representative Stevenson, you have response.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I did receive in the last few days a couple of proposed changes. I did say after consulting with other stakeholders that they were acceptable, and we did submit that for drafting. There's just, you know, a lot going on in the revisor's office right now, so we didn't we're able to do it by today, but certainly we'll be able to take care of that
before we move it up, before we move it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Wold. And again, hope we'll continue to work with the author to make sure before we bring it back up that we have that those suggestions and we can try and work them in as the amendment.
Of course, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next person I have is the Mike Soon, our son. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Mike Sun, S-O-N-N. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sun. I've been a public employee since 2006, and I'm a member of Ask Me Council 5. I currently work for MnDOT as a transportation specialist. In 2007, shortly after graduating from the University of Wisconsin River Falls, I started working for the County of San Mateo in the San Francisco Bay Area. I had approximately $25,000 in student loan debt. I looked into what options I had for repayment, and I decided to begin participating in the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. I made payments to loan servicing companies for 10 years, during which I was led to believe that I was on the right path and that my loans would be forgiven. So it was a shock to me that when I reached 120 loan payments in 2016 and was informed that I had not been making qualifying payments. Then in 2017, Congress created a temporary expanded public service loan forgiveness to help people like me who didn't qualify due to poor communication around what a qualifying payment was. Sadly, I was in for another surprise when I was again denied loan forgiveness because I had consolidated my loans in 2012, and that had apparently reset my payment count. I don't recall ever being informed that by consolidating my loans, I would have to start my 120 payments over from when I consolidated. However, what the loan servicer did tell me after being denied a second time in 2 years was that by the time I did complete my payments in 2022, the temporary expanded public service loan forgiveness program would likely be out of money and would be unable to honor my promise of loan forgiveness. I felt like I didn't have anyone to turn to for help. If I had the resources of the proposed student loan advocate, I might have made different choices when it came to repaying my debt. I definitely would have had a place to turn when my forgiveness was denied twice. The educational materials a student loan advocate would be required to produce would have been incredibly valuable to me back in 2006 when I started public service loan forgiveness, in 2012 when I consolidated my loans. In 2016 when I realized I had at least 6 more years of repayments. And in 2017 when I had no assurances that I would be able to have my debt forgiven. It's entirely possible that in 2022, when I again apply for loan forgiveness, I'll be denied for some reason that I haven't been informed on yet. If this bill is passed into law, I might finally have some recourse if that does come to pass. I want to thank Representative Stevenson for bringing this bill forward, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Thank you.
Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak on this bill? Seeing no one rushing to the podium, Representative Quam, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it was for Mr.
Welly. I see him coming back to the podium.
And looking at the bill and the timing, I'm trying to understand. And the only thing that comes to mind is recently, the previous administration did some tweaking to the student loan program. And is this bill predicated because of unintended consequences from that tweaking? Or is it that previous attorney generals have not done an adequate job, or the Department of Education hasn't done an adequate job?
Mr. Welly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Department of Education has been very active in the last few years, in the last 5 to 10 years, in going back and forth on certain rules on loan forgiveness. They mostly revolve around fraud. That is, there are rules, federal rules and statutes that provide that a student can have their loan, their federal student loans forgiven if they are a victim of fraud, if the school that enrolled them committed some fraud or violation of state law. And the rules around how those loans are forgiven have changed a lot in recent years. The main issue that we've been seeing, and some of the testifiers have been talking about, is a different type of loan forgiveness around public service loan forgiveness. If someone is in a qualifying public service job, they can potentially have their loans forgiven after 10 years of qualifying payments. If someone is not in a public service position, they can have their loans potentially forgiven after 20 years of qualifying payments. There are lots of different rules and provisions and guidelines around what counts as a qualifying payment, what counts as a qualifying employer, things that borrowers have to do. And what we have seen in recent years is that servicers have not been accurately disclosing and describing those qualifications with borrowers. And that's what one of the main purposes of this bill is, to address that issue and to make sure that this advocate is in place and to educate borrowers and to make sure that servicers are held accountable when they give inaccurate information about these loan forgiveness programs.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Welly, it seems pretty evident that a lot of the regulations, guidelines, directions, et cetera, are from the federal level on this. You seem to be talking and referencing issues regarding to some federal programs. And also, frankly, Department of Ed should be, and higher ed should be concerned with informing and helping to understand. Fraud sounds like something that the Attorney General's previous and present should be addressing as part of their mission. If there's a fix to bad regulations and stuff, it sounds like these are federal programs and issues, but this committee is basically, the bill is for us to look at, do we need to do something with the Attorney General's office because they haven't been doing their job, or it's outside or something new? This doesn't sound like something new. It sounds like something that the Attorney General's office, it's part of your mission statement, should be addressing. And, fraud's underneath there. So I'm confused as to why it's here. And the part about education, I believe, is to higher ed and the Department of Ed, and not the purview of this committee. So I understand that this will be looked at for further consideration. I hope we also look at truly where this activity should be placed. And, you know, frankly, you know, if there's a problem, they should have and should be taking care of it already.
Well, funding of the Attorney General's office is in our purview. So Representative Stevenson, you have
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, I just want to note two things. One is that while these are federal programs, they are administered by private student loan servicing companies. Those private student loan servicing companies are the companies that are engaged in the bad behavior that has been described in this committee today. That's the entities that need to be policed, and that the Attorney General needs new tools, which has been the testimony of the witnesses here today, to address that problem. I also want to just address the scale of the problem is enormous and growing so fast that it is something new. Just with respect to the members of the committee who have suggested otherwise, student loan debt has increased 127% in the last 10 years. It is the second leading cause of debt in the United States. That is not the way it's always been. These are new things. It's a new problem, the scope of it.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, frankly, it's been expanding, and maybe that's because the high schools and colleges aren't helping to inform and educate, which should be part of their mission, so that, you know, students are better aware of before getting into it. There's prevention. And there's action. The education is prevention. The action is the fraud action. And I guess we ask and expect the Attorney General's office to handle these things. Are we just saying you're not doing it? And I guess I'll let us address it if it comes up again.
Members, we have two more bills we have to get done this morning, and otherwise we'll have to come back later this evening. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to second Representative Stevenson's comments, as part of the research I've been doing trying to understand the dynamics of the housing market, the demographers are telling me that basically the millennial generation is doing everything that their parents did, except that they're doing it 10 years later because of the crushing burden of student loan debt. Because of student loans, they can't accumulate the data they need for the money they need for down payments, and so they're buying houses later. They're starting their families later, which is also depressing birth rates, which will have an effect on our future workforce. So this isn't just a consumer problem. This is a societal problem that needs to be addressed. And then the second point I'd like to make is that in the course of the research I've been doing on a data privacy bill that I'm developing, I've had occasion to meet with the Attorney General's office, because that bill will ultimately require a fiscal note as well. And I've learned that the size of the AG staff has been shrinking over time, I understand. Those of you who have been around longer would understand that better than me. But it's basically, there isn't the capacity there for them to pick up new responsibilities we give them without funding, whether it's, you know, enforcement of student loan provisions or enforcement of a data privacy bill.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. It's been said that the millennial generation are buying a house that they can't live in. That's the scope of some of the student loans that are there. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, can you give me some Representative Stevenson, can you give me some examples of qualifying loans and why it's so difficult for people to understand what a qualifying loan is?
Is that a qualifying payment, I think, is what qualifying loan payment?
Right, exactly. Thank you.
Representative Stevenson.
So I think if you're talking specifically about the public service loan forgiveness, you need to be in a federal loan program. Some people will refinance their loan into private loans, and that's a very big problem. Another example would be not being in the right type of repayment plan. You need to be in an income-driven repayment plan. There are a variety of other repayment plans that you could be in for a period of time, and you might think qualify you for public service loan forgiveness, and you'd be making payments for 10 years and not be accruing towards your actual loan forgiveness under the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. That program started in 2007 under the Bush administration, so the first people who theoretically were eligible in 2017 for loan forgiveness. In the first couple years of processing loan forgiveness, 98% of applicants were denied.
And this is a little beyond our purview, but Representative Mason, do you have a follow-up question?
No, thank you.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do think this is something that is really important that we talk about, and this is not something that high schools can teach students necessarily, because students aren't necessarily the only ones taking out loans for themselves. My family has experienced this. My partner's father passed away from very serious and rare brain disease, and in his time suffering from this disease, it caused him to make financial decisions that he normally wouldn't have. And among those financial decisions, we're taking out student loans in his children's name. My family has spent significant amounts of time untangling these loans. We have found that my partner alone has over, has tens of thousands of dollars worth of debt that he never took out. So I know that this department would be really helpful investigating and finding loans that we don't even know that we have. Trying to deal with this has caused us to delay a lot of those major life decisions that Representative Elkins has talked about. We have not gotten married, for example, or pursued having children because we do not know, we don't even know to the extent of which our loans are detangled. So having someone in the Attorney General's office is something that would not only help myself, but people beyond that. So I think you can do all of the preparation and learning about financial literacy in the world, but it's not going to protect you when other things happen. So having an advocate for consumers and for students and for families in the Attorney General's office is really something that I think would go a long way and is something that would really make life better for Minnesotans and I think help our economy too.
And so I was passed a note here from the AG that cost efficiencies in the Attorney General's office come when attorneys can specialize on a topic, and because they're specializing on a topic and they see multiple cases over on, instead of one person seeing one and another person seeing one, that they see the emergence of bad actors and they see patterns that where bad actors or where people are doing things that are wrong. And that's one of the reasons why the Attorney General is asking for this. Representative Stephen, if you want to wrap up. And
Mr. Chair, this is a great bill. Thank you for hearing it, and I look forward to talking with you further in the future.
Thank you. With that, we'll lay this over for further consideration. And members, the next bill on the list is Representative Hunter Cantrell, House File 1257. And members, this bill is before us because of the CEGA portion of this. And so, again, if we may want to stray into other things, but if we can keep our questions and our comments related to that. And I believe there's somebody here from the MMB. Why don't you come on up, because that's part of the bill that with CGIP that we deal with. Welcome to the committee, Representative Cantrell. I'll move that House File 1257 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And if you want to describe your bill.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be able to present House File 1257 before you today. House File 1257 prohibits, with, I think, reasonable off-ramps, the practice of mid-year formulary switching. The current situation is one in which folks who often undergo long-term trial and error processes to arrive at one specific drug or a specific combination of drugs to treat complex or chronic illness such as depression, epilepsy, or multiple sclerosis oftentimes choose a health plan at the beginning of the contract year because it covers their one specific drug that works for them. So as it stands right now in the state of Minnesota, health plans are able to say, yes, this is the drug that will be on the formulary at the beginning of the contract year, but 3 months into it, we can take you off this one drug that might be able to stabilize your multiple sclerosis, that might be able to prevent you from having seizures if you have epilepsy, or might actually be effective in treating your depression. All serious and chronic conditions that really adversely affect the quality of life for many Minnesotans. So as I said, this bill has reasonable off-ramps. If health plans find a drug that is therapeutically equivalent, if they find a drug that's cheaper, I mean, it is something that I think is not only workable, but also something that will improve the quality of life for patients in Minnesota struggling with chronic and complex illnesses especially. The fiscal cost associated with the bill is estimated to be about $350,000 every 4 years, or every two biennium, and that is largely, from my assessment from the fiscal note, a result of CGIP anticipating that there may be an increase in administrative costs. However, I would say that that the increase in the costs is, it would be, in my personal opinion, offset by the preservation of the quality of life of patients in Minnesota, in patients who are enrolled in CGIP. And with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will turn over to the testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Galen Benshuth. I'm Assistant Director of CGIP over at MMB. Thank you for the opportunity to explain our fiscal note from last year related to House File 1257. First, for a little bit of context, MMB contracts with the pharmacy benefit manager to perform a number of duties, including claims administration, bulk purchasing, customer service, and formulary management. The formulary that we have contracted for is our PBM standard formulary. Other formularies do carry an added cost. Our understanding last year was that this bill would mean a custom formulary, a non-standard formulary with our PBM, and therefore we would see an additional administrative cost with our vendor. We estimated that cost to be $100,000 annually due to increased manual work on the vendor side to maintain and update this relatively unique formulary model. We did receive a new fiscal note request earlier this week, and so we will get updated information soon, and that most recent information we have will certainly be reflected on the new fiscal note we submit in the near future. We don't anticipate major changes at this point, but we do want to make sure we track down the latest for you all. The definite change that you will see in our new fiscal note is splitting out the cost to the overall CGIP plan versus the cost to agencies. This is beginning this year, we're assuming in all of our fiscal notes that when CGIP does need to collect additional premium revenue to pay for an increased cost, 87.3 of those added costs will be paid by agencies. And that's because agencies pay a majority but not all of the premiums that come into the CGIP plan. So that's a change that you'll see for sure. And we don't expect any other changes to the fiscal note at this time, but that one change will mean a slightly lower cost, assuming all else stays constant, to our response from last year.
And my understanding is that new fiscal note will be there before this gets heard in Ways and Means. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cantrell, one of the things that we talk about on page 13 of the fiscal note is the additional cost that would be incurred by CGIP, which we are covered under with our health plan. And by virtue of that, would you agree that this plan or this proposal would then expand the cost issues for private plans in the private market?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, can you please reword your question? I want to make sure that I'm understanding it precisely.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons why I raise the question is in your proposal and the budget and the bill on page on line 1.11 as well as 1.13 for private plans, they're only allowed to change their formulary or contract terms every 12 months, but you're availing CGIP to once every quarter. So when we talk about the costs that may be incurred by the CGIP formulary, you note on the last line of the second to last paragraph, an additional cost, that's only exacerbated by the fact that the private market will only be able to change their formulary every 12 months. So there is an additional cost that will be incurred by the private markets. Is that correct?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and thank you, Representative Albright. So if I understand your question correctly, asking if there will be an additional cost incurred by the private market, I am not sure that that will necessarily come to bear. This is already a market of immense profits, so I'm not sure what, if any, cost would be authentic or be able to be independently verified, as so much of the economy within our healthcare market is already highly inflated by actors who want to make money off people's health. So that's probably the best answer that I have for your question. That would be my assessment of the healthcare economy.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I'll just leave with it. Mr. Kent, Representative Cantrell, your comments are subjective. I don't know that they are based in fact. When you say that people are making money off of people's health, that's a subjective term. You can say what you want, but whether you're a nonprofit or for profit, there are costs that are necessary to provide health care. Whether we agree or disagree, I think you're dealing in the subjective.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you. I have a quick question and a comment. A quick question would be, who is our PBM?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, thank you for the question. We currently contract with CVS CareMore for PBM administration.
Representative Elkins.
And then the comment would be that in the course of researching another of my bills related to drug prices, I've discovered that in the vast majority of cases, the PBMs are currently, the big PBMs at least, are successfully negotiating hold harmless clauses in their contracts with drug manufacturers. So for the most part, during the course of a plan year, the drug prices being negotiated by PBMs on behalf of the health plans are frozen.
No further questions. You want to wrap up your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate you being willing to hear this bill today, and I will iterate my point that there is massive profit being gained in the healthcare industry. This is indisputable. It is backed by evidence and objective data. I appreciate you hearing this bill to reduce the cost of drugs for Minnesotans and to ensure that they are able to have continuity of care, knowing that if they have a chronic illness in Minnesota, that they will not be hung out to dry by our current regulations and by our healthcare system. I thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
And before I forget, is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak on this bill? I see no one running down to the podium. I renew my motion that House File 1257 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
Short recess.
And members, we'll take a short recess here, waiting for Representative Lesh to come down. We set the page up to get him.
It's morning and I haven't had enough coffee expression.
Oh.
I wanted to make sure you were.
Maybe you didn't watch enough TV like 15 years ago.
No.
What's that?
Oh, I had the traffic is unbearable face. But we'll build trains to get out of the problem. Keating was saying that
they put new ones these down every day,
and
they're gone by the end of the day.
I just
get that email from MMB. We get these accounting systems that they now have a special code for COVID-19 activities.
Train down the 55.
Put all this stuff, look at
bus rapid transit. I'm all for wheels. Perhaps I'll take a look at it.
At least we'll know those.
What will be a way? When if we get when and if
this
we get
is in the bus?
Just as long as it's not an electric bus. They're too expensive.
When do you introduce it?
I have electric buses being built in my world.
Did you see that about the fire trucks out in California?
No.
The typical fire truck is $750,000. Now they're buying electric ones that are
members. Representative Lesh is here. We'll call this up back to order. Representative Lesh, welcome to the committee. I'll move that House File 4 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Lesh.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We're talking about the Attorney General costs, as I understand it.
That's correct.
Okay. If I could defer to fiscal folks or anyone from the Attorney General's office who's here.
Since I don't work there.
I see somebody coming down here and... Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm James Cannaday, Deputy Attorney General. I oversee the Consumer Protection section at the Attorney General's office, and I'm here to explain the fiscal note for HF4. So I would first note that the price gouging authority given to the Attorney General's office in HF4 is new authority. The Attorney General's office would not, in the absence of this bill, have authority over price gouging or price gouging for pharmaceuticals, which is what this specifically addresses. So the expenditures are summarized in the fiscal note. I'll just give a high-level overview, and then I'd be happy to answer questions. There are two main components that make up the expenditures. The first component is staffing costs. There's a request for one FTE attorney position and one FTE investigator position to oversee this work. This is a conservative estimate in the sense that it is not indicative of the workload that will be given to the Attorney General's office. We go through all the detail in the note to explain the assumptions we make about the number of investigations and litigation that will result from this authority. It is essentially assuming 15 investigations per year and potentially 5 litigation eligible, 5 of the investigations that progress to litigation each year. The attorney and investigator that are requested by the fiscal note are to oversee all of that work, but there will be many other attorneys and investigators already in the Attorney General's office that would also be working on those matters. The second component of the expenditures is for experts that would be necessary in order to pursue these matters. The standard in the bill that we would be looking at is whether the prices charged by the manufacturers or wholesalers are unconscionable. In order to investigate that and prove that, we would need expert witnesses to look at the information and to testify in court. And so the costs for those are laid out. There is revenue projected in the fiscal note that we submitted. To compare it to the student loan bill that you heard earlier today, this is one of the circumstances that I would consider relatively rare where we think it's definitive enough to project revenue. But we would clarify that by statute, any revenue goes to the general fund. That does not come to the Attorney General's office. The factors that make this different than the other bills, since you're hearing about both of them at the same time, I just want to explain that. These are matters where we would be investigating, by definition, pharmaceutical companies or wholesalers. These are big established companies, and we believe that authority, when we're looking at the number of investigations that we're projecting, would likely lead to litigation that would result in recovery of costs, which are allowed under the statute, and imposition of civil penalties. So we've projected the revenue after consultation with the Legislative Budget Office because we think it gives a better, more complete picture of the net cost to the state, but it does not affect the expenditures side from the Attorney General's office. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And members, we have an amendment here that the A6 amendment, do you have that, Representative Lesh?
I do.
A little consultation up here. We have a, and then we have a slight oral amendment or a modification we need to do to the A6 amendment. Then I'll let our fiscal analyst, Ms. Roberts, describe that.
Mr. Chair and members, I think you need to look at page 4 of the fiscal note. The amendment as drafted has the base for the appropriation at $267,000 in the tails, and that's actually a net number including the revenues that were just discussed. But if the actual expenditure and appropriation without the revenues included should be $527,000. So on line 1.6, where it says 267,000, it would be 527,000.
Mr. Roberts, is that in both places?
In both places.
And I'll just incorporate that into the amendment. So I'll move the A6 amendment with the incorporation, the change to the number on line 1.6. Members, any discussion on the amendment? If not, all in favor of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Members, questions of the Representative Lesh or the Attorney General's office?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many fiscal or forensic fiscal investigators does the office currently have?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the position we're talking about is not specifically called a fiscal investigator. It's a general investigator akin to what we have for our consumer fraud investigations. And so the consumer protection section currently has, I believe, 3 investigator positions that we use for all of our consumer protection work. This would be in addition to that.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm specifically trying to understand your current capabilities on forensics of, you know, fiscal records, because that expertise is something that is would be key to determining, you know, the expenses of R&D, you know, et cetera, to be able to do these, you know, I guess pick out what you think or feel is excessive or not excessive. And so is there currently that type of expertise internally?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. In fact, in specific answer to your question, I would say we have no one with that expertise currently. And the intention with this position is both to get into the financial information, which would be kind of the focus of such an investigation here, and to interface with all of the other both attorneys and then outside expertise that we would need to engage to do that.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This type or this activity seems like it could be similar to a previous one with a previous AG where they farmed out to private law firms and ended up being hundreds of millions of dollars of you know, compensation, whether it was attorney fees or to the state or the firms. Is there the intent that is there anything precluding or preventing you from doing that in this case of midway through just saying, hey, we're going to hand this off to an outside group and we'll split the you know, proceeds from any cases?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the situation you're referring to would have involved a contingency fee contract with an outside law firm, which has happened in cases where the Attorney General's office has been unable with its resources to handle a particular matter. There are no assumptions here for such a model being employed, and in fact, the request is an attempt to be able to do this work within the Attorney General's office and then to recover revenue that would come from it.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And part of my concern is you've said the AG's office has no experience in fiscal forensics. I asked, and you basically said, no, this is a general we're hiring a general investigator. This specialized area, I think, might balloon the expenditures and budgets to get the people to actually do what you're looking at doing. And that's why I have the concern that, maybe this hasn't been thought through completely to understand the appropriate resources, scaling, and et cetera. We just had an amendment that went from being less than a $1 million, and the oral correction now has it up to about $1.5 million. I just have concerns that this isn't fully baked and ready.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The structure and, I guess, culture of the Minnesota Attorney General's office has changed quite a bit over the years. It was, I guess, 2004, 2005, when the exclusively litigation components that stuck with the office, and you got general counsel in some of the different departments for those civil legal services, and so that was not exclusively with the Attorney General's office itself. On the litigation side of things, it became more exclusively litigation during the time of Hatch Swanson, and so there was more need to farm out and get expertise outside the Attorney General's office itself, especially with the growing expertise of the other industries or regulated industries that the Attorney General was overseeing. That said, even in the days of Skip Humphrey, when much more of the Attorney General's office services were in-house, specifically under the aegis of the Attorney General, even then, we had probably the biggest farming out litigation that this state had seen in the tobacco settlement, north of $6 billion, which less than 10 years later we monetized, kind of like The Big Short, and lost it, really, to solve a budget deficit. But even that was done under Skip Humphrey. So there is a long practice of this owing itself to the fact that when you've got an in-house public law office that has to go up against companies that have legal budgets larger than many small countries, that expertise is going to be necessary. And if an outside firm is willing to take on the risk, the contingency risk, Minnesota taxpayers win on that every time.
Representative Quam.
Not diverting too far, but part of my issue or concern is the expertise with this task, and $1.5 million, I can see this ballooning expense-wise just to fund the appropriate scale of investigation and going through years or decades of research and financials before you can reach the point of deciding, is it valid to do a case? So I'm just concerned that this is going to balloon into a large budget item. And you mentioned or referenced willing to take the risk. I'd like to know what the upfront cost will be. And I don't think we quite have that, even with the fiscal analysis, because of obviously the AG doesn't have that in-house expertise, so they're not maybe as familiar with what the exposure could be. So that's part of my concern about this, that it's not quite ready.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesch, or to the testifier, I note on page 9 of the bill with regard to the effective date that you have put a fairly unique clawback provision in here, retroactively giving opportunity to the AG's office to look at all drugs, basically all the way back to July 1st of 2014. My question, because of the purview of this committee, is what effect would that effective date have on your fiscal note?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, from my point of view, the fact that the effective date is retroactive simply means that if this authority is given to the Attorney General's office, we're able to look at the marketplace and determine what the appropriate investigations to begin are. If we had a more common situation with the legislation that you're probably comparing it to, where it goes into effect either upon passing or in the future, we would essentially have a waiting period beyond that date to see what occurred in the marketplace, because that's what the behavior that's being asked to look at here is. So the retroactive effective date allows us to, if given the authority, look at the pricing that has existed in the marketplace and take appropriate action.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so from your perspective, there would be no effect on the fiscal statement.
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's no added cost in the projections that we gave because of a retroactive effective date.
Mr. Chair, just one final question.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. And the fiscal note with regard to the AG's office, under the assumptions, point number 3, there are a number of assumptions that are not articulated by a financial cost attributable to them other than as a base with regard to the constitutionality of this bill in its entirety. And it is cited in the fiscal note, the Maryland case. But I'm just wondering, going forward, do you anticipate preparing for a court case based upon the constitutionality, if and when this would ever become law?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we're not projecting costs for that. For the sake of completeness, we decided it was appropriate to acknowledge that there was an issue with the price gouging law in Maryland that was different than the law we're talking about here. And actually, the main reason that assumption was in there is this fiscal note started last year when that matter was ongoing, and so the information's there. We're not projecting any costs for it, and if there were to be a challenge hypothetically, then that would be something that would presumably put the law on hold, and so we would not have the other expenditures that we are talking about in our fiscal note.
Representative Albright.
That's all.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
But I could also add that the Maryland law, as has been stated, is different from this law. And we crafted this law specifically to be different and exclusive to drugs sold in Minnesota, so that it would survive any potential similar challenge if the Eighth Circuit or the Minnesota federal court would follow the, I guess, direction of Maryland or the Fourth Circuit, which they don't need to. Okay, it's illegal in the Fourth Circuit on Maryland law. It's not here. So just to be clear, and I think there's cert going up to the Supreme Court or something right now on it, but it hasn't happened. So as it stands right now, even the exact same law passed in Maryland, which this is not, would be absolutely legal and permissible here to protect Minnesota consumers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, the Commerce Clause applies to all 50 states, and whether or not a piece of litigation was settled in another state under a different jurisdiction, The litigation itself will still have to be prosecuted in the state of Minnesota under the district courts that we have. Whether or not it is presumptive on your part to know the outcome of that litigation, you still need to prepare for the costs.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lesch. I understand perhaps some of the motive of what you're trying to do here. I'm not a pharmaceutical manufacturer, nor do I pretend to be an expert about it, but decades ago I spent a number of years in the healthcare industry and profession, and I've seen things really change over these times. The innovations that have occurred for the benefit of everybody really are remarkable. We, meaning many of us who fit into the baby boom group, we have had impacts on our culture and our society from the time of post-World War II. We put great stresses on schools and education, then colleges, then housing, employment markets, and here we are at a juncture where many of us are older, and most of us know that in the healthcare industry, most people consume about 80% of their healthcare costs in the last 3 years of life. And so, in the innovation of drugs, these companies have patents for a period of time to recoup their R&D and to generate a profit before generics are available. They've done all the hard work in developing a recipe that works. Today we often see consumers are somewhat at the crux of the problem in that they demand something when they go to the doctor. They want immediate fix for their anomaly. All you have to do is watch TV at night and ask your doctor if this will help. Ask your doctor if this will help. And people want something when they go out the door because otherwise they feel they're not being treated. But you brought up an issue of outside counsel and not being able to go up against the big dollars. You made reference to then Attorney General Skip Humphrey. I think I recall back in those days a tobacco lawsuit, which was to protect consumers. And apparently we didn't have any competence within our own Attorney General's office that it was decided that an outside law firm had to litigate this. And I think the award was substantial, in the billions for the state of Minnesota. And the state of Minnesota is supposed to be representing the people. And I recall back then that the Cerisi law firm got about $500 million as their share of the settlement. Representative Lesch, is that type of compensation unconscionable?
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think if you apply this toward what Republicans are fond of considering in the business world, is $500 million to get $7.5 billion for the taxpayers of Minnesota unconscionable? I think any business mind would say that makes quite a bit of sense. If you're talking about the win that you get from the taxpayers, and that does not even count the billions that we have saved in healthcare costs from people not dying from tobacco over the course of the last 20 years. So unconscionable, that's a great question. But just from a fiscal standpoint, it probably makes a heck of a lot of business sense, $500 million for $7.5 billion. And then the scores that we save in healthcare costs, I don't know, unconscionable. I think it's in the eye of the beholder.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure which testifier, but going back to the fiscal note, bottom of page four, going into the really top of page five, looking at the outside costs that are going to be generated or necessary. And it says that you're going to have 15 brand name investigations each year, costing $5,000. I'm wondering what kind of expertise you're budgeting for there.
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the assumptions are assuming that we would look into 15 different drugs. The standard under the law would be looking for unconscionable pricing. And so by definition, it's going to require looking at development, marketing, and kind of all costs of that drug. The law requires the Attorney General's office to get input from the pharmaceutical manufacturer or wholesaler in addition to the discovery rights that we have. In other words, even if we were to choose to somehow do this without talking to the manufacturer, the law actually requires us, in this case, to get input from the manufacturer. And so all of that is assumed to be technical, largely financial, but not exclusively financial information that we would be getting from pharmaceutical manufacturers. Some perspective that I would add that's both responsive to your question and some of the questions that Representative Plum asked that got to the issue of not having the ability within the Attorney General's office right now to do this. I want to be clear about that. We would need to bring in this outside financial expertise to do the analysis and to provide expert testimony in court and be able to convince a judge that we think there's been unconscionable pricing. The Attorney General's office does have existing expertise that we use every day in regard to suing pharmaceutical companies for all kinds of other things. We do not use outside counsel for the matters I'm talking about. It's work that I oversee. I've been in the office for over 12 years. I can tell you that in the time I've been there, I've been involved in probably at least two dozen, but maybe more than that, big contested litigation with all of the major pharmaceutical manufacturers. We've brought in probably tens of millions of dollars in recovery that has gone to the state of Minnesota and has gone to the general fund. It's been done with our resources in-house, but this is something entirely new where we would need the expertise that's being talked about here. Now more in response to your specific question, the other thing I would just clarify, again, it's laid out in more detail in the note, but the cost was calculated by assuming that if we did 15 investigations, we would have costs in each of those investigations of $5,000. That's assumed to be 25 hours on each one of those by that outside expert at a rate of $200 an hour. And then from within that group of 15, where we're doing that kind of evaluation stage to figure out what the lay of the land is, there's an assumption that perhaps five of those would be appropriate for litigation. And so there are additional costs for experts with more time in those five. That's the methodology that I think you were specifically wanting to drill down.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So my question is that if you're a drug company and doing research and so forth, that this isn't a one-on-one thing. In other words, you're looking at capital formation. We're going through an event right now with the coronavirus where it may take hundreds of millions of dollars of research, so therefore each drug may not be paying for its own research. And what I'm assuming here is if you're going to be fair and look at this, you're going to have to take a fairly deep dive into those financials to look at it holistically rather than just how much did it cost them for this drug to manufacture it and now produce it. So how are you going to approach that deep dive on $5,000 when you've got this large company that you're looking at their entire financial situation?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I accept your premise as something that I would not be surprised to hear from a target of an investigation. I think that's something that we expect will happen. I guess one comment I would make is, when we are asked to prepare a fiscal note for litigation and to project costs for investigation and litigation, it's a series of assumptions, and we are bound to only make assumptions that we can support and that we think are conservative. And so that's what we've done here, and I think that we would be prepared to figure out the scope of the investigation that you suggest that might be expansive within the resources that we have.
Turpson and Vogel.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, that kind of builds on my concern, is that what's going to happen here is if you're going to do this relative to the fiscal note and the accuracy of the fiscal note, the way the bill is being passed, that it may not be fair to the companies that are being investigated, because indeed, you know, a simple little audit can cost $20,000 or $30,000 on a simple little company, and now you're going to go into a large complex company and try to figure out whether or not they wronged the customer with, you know, overcharging, and then if indeed there's a suggestion that they did relative to this limited information, maybe a suit is brought. And I recognize that a lot of times larger companies will settle because it's a lot cheaper to just settle and pay a fine than it is to go through and litigate yourself not guilty of whatever's being done. So I just question, Mr. Chair, and the bill author is, the fiscal note is, I think, making an assumption relative to what the AG's office has provided it, something that is, I don't see how you're going to do this. How are you going to possibly investigate a large drug company, look at their entire capital formation structure because they're producing a lot of different drugs, and then determine that this particular drug is being overcharged for without looking at the entire company?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Lesh.
So, you know, Representative Vogel, I accept your premise that if the AG were to go down that rabbit hole, it would change some dynamics of the cost. However, keep in mind that there are so many drugs out there for whom you don't need to get anywhere near close to that. You need merely scratch the surface. Martin Shkreli jacked up the price of Daraprim by 5,000%. He didn't manufacture the drug. He didn't manufacture any other drugs. He bought the patent, saw what he could use as market exploitation, and increase the price of a drug 5,000% because he could. You don't need to do much analysis to find out whether or not he was subsidizing the R&D on some other drug, because that's not what he does. Insulin, as an example, that patent was given away for a dollar to the University of Toronto. Okay, it's almost 100 years old. It really hasn't changed much. There are some differences, of course, but it's essentially there are three manufacturers in the world, and they're jacking the price up from $15 a vial to several hundred dollars a vial. You don't need to do much research to find out, you know, if they're using that to subsidize other drugs. There are countless examples of these that the Attorney General can do with minimal investigation that pharma knows that they're vulnerable on. They're hugely vulnerable on. So I think there's, you know, a potentially eventuality that years down the road, if the Attorney General were to decide they were really going to try that type of forensic analysis, they could. But I don't think it makes a lot of sense for them to have to do that at all right now based upon the egregious examples of price gouging we have in the market without really having to do much work to discover it.
And members, we're running short of time here, so if we can keep our questions short and our answers short, that'd be great.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just suggest that if we're going to do legislation, it needs to be objective and it needs to be fair. And I don't see how you're going to do a fair analysis of a large drug company for $5,000 before they're possibly charged with something that may even look like a crime. Thank you.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, and I'll keep this short. But I've also been doing a ton of research in this area. I've got a bill that would just require the drug manufacturers just to reveal to the public what their prices are. I think the public would be shocked. But I think Representative Vogel's point is well taken to some degree, because all of my research is telling me is that cost is simply not a factor in the pricing of drugs. In fact, there's, you know, I'll provide the reports on this, but for example, the drug companies have the lowest percentage of cost of goods sold of any manufacturing industry. They have the highest profit margins of any manufacturing industry, and all of the investigations, a really good U.S. Senate investigation on this topic that revealed that basically As far as the investigators could determine, the only factor that the drug companies used in the pricing of their drugs is how high can we price them before the health plans and PBMs push back and say, I'm sorry, that's too expensive for us to include in our formularies. We're just not going to cover this drug. That's the only thing that's limiting the price of patented drugs.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And getting back to the point of the AG, I know there are a lot of emotional issues in here, but if you use the assumption of past history of drugs, there are a lot of innovations, especially in the genetic component of the trials, and the interaction of something was discovered with another drug, and now you have to have additional United States enforces a lot of research. It takes longer to do, so therefore you've got a bigger trail of paper, a bigger trail of the financials, and you cannot make the assumption because these other drugs from years ago, so you'd have to actually look in detail in that drug and that family of drugs, and that would require much more activity than the fiscal note is indicating, and that's, I believe, the line of questioning is aiming at, and us being able to understand exactly what the cost is would incur us to decide whether to include it or not, and that's why this line of questioning, I think, is very important. Scratching the surface does not give us the details that we actually would need, and the expertise, obviously, has been stated that they don't have in the forensics.
Is there... Before I go to Representative Albright, is there anybody else in the audience that needs to speak on this bill or wishes to speak on this bill? Representative Albright, shortly. We got a couple minutes.
Very short question. It's a yes or no for Representative Lesh. Representative Lesh, if House File 4 became law, can you guarantee the prices will go down?
I'll give you the same answer.
Representative Lesh,
I'll give you the same answer that insurance companies or HMOs say anytime they come in asking to be let off the hook on regulations. No.
That's all I needed to know.
With that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 4, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion passes. Members, with that, seeing nothing else on our agenda, we're adjourned.